Washington, Court of Appeals, Division 1 is now in session. The Honorable Stephen J. Fryer presiding.
Good to be seated, everybody.
First up is State versus Lopez.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Dana Nelson on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Zayas Lopez. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please. There are several issues in this case, three specifically. I'd like to focus on the mistrial motion and rest on the briefing with regard to the others, unless the Court has specific questions about those. The motion for mistrial was based on Joanne Mettler's testimony. She's the advanced nurse practitioner who interviewed AB, and she testified that at the end of her interview with AB, wherein AB talked about or disclosed alleged sexual abuse, the nurse told AB that this has happened to other kids and that she was very brave for coming forward and talking about it. It's our position that the motion for mistrial based on this testimony should have been granted because Ms. Mettler's testimony was a serious trial irregularity that so prejudiced Mr. Zayas Lopez that he did not receive a fair trial. A mistrial should be granted. Whether a mistrial should be granted, this court looks at several factors: the seriousness of the irregularity, whether the testimony was cumulative, and whether a curative instruction was given. And it's our position that all three of these factors weigh in favor of the granting of the motion for a mistrial. First, looking at the Montgomery factors, the five factors in that case that we cite in our brief, it's clear that Ms. Mettler's testimony amounted to an improper opinion on guilt. It's black-letter law that the state should not offer opinion testimony to the effect that the defendant is guilty. And by testifying that this has happened to other kids, specifically after AB disclosed what had allegedly happened to her, and by telling AB that she was very brave for coming forward, Ms. Mettler essentially said, "I believe AB, and therefore Mr. Zayas Lopez is guilty." Now, turning to the factors, the first thing that this court considers under Montgomery in determining whether it was an opinion on guilt is the person, the type of witness involved. And here we would argue that the type of witness, the advanced nurse practitioner, supports finding that this was an improper opinion. She was called as an expert. Again, her training supports that she was an expert. She testified that she performs these head-to-toe physical examinations of suspected child rape victims. And so due to her advanced medical expertise and the aura of scientific reliability of her testimony, we contend that jurors would naturally attach significant weight to her testimony. The second factor, the specific nature of the testimony, I've already gone over that. The fact she essentially said that she believed AB, and this is important because it's also black-letter law that experts or medical experts aren't supposed to give an opinion about whether sexual abuse occurred when it's just based on an interview with the alleged child victim. And in this case, the exam results were normal. So, and Ms. Mettler testified that she did not notice anything abnormal in the physical exam. Therefore, her opinion that AB was telling the truth was necessarily based on her interview with the child. And finally, Your Honors, the third, fourth, and fifth factors of Montgomery also support finding that Mettler's testimony was improper. The nature of the charges here are such that there usually is not an eyewitness to what supposedly happened. And that is the case here, as the state in argument conceded and during voir dire also talked to the jurors about the fact that there would be no physical evidence, no DNA, no eyewitnesses, and that it would really just boil down to the child's testimony. And significantly, Mr. Zayas Lopez denied the charges, and there were reasons given for why she might have fabricated them. So under these circumstances, the cases have held that a medical expert's testimony that the child is telling the truth is particularly prejudicial. Turning to the other factors supporting mistrial, the testimony wasn't cumulative. and there was no curative instruction given. In fact, the court did not sustain defense counsel's timely objection to the testimony that it did not pertain to medical diagnosis or treatment. And when defense counsel, 60 pages later in the transcript, moved for a mistrial on grounds that it also was an improper opinion, the court did not find that it was an improper opinion. And the court's reasoning was that, well, this is just something that a child interview specialist might say to keep the child talking. And we believe that that was actually an unrealistic view of the testimony because jurors are not seasoned trial attorneys or seasoned judges. And having this person presented to them as an expert, somebody who does this kind of thing all the time, jurors would naturally give that testimony heightened credibility. And significantly, Mettler did not say that this is something that she typically says to potential child abuse victims. And she also said that this was towards the end of her interview, not at the beginning. So I don't think that jurors would naturally conclude that this is just something that is said as a matter of course. So for all those reasons, we would argue that the trial court's rationale for denying the motion for mistrial should be rejected. Under the circumstances, Your Honor, it's highly probable that the jury viewed Ms. Mettler's testimony as a serious expression of her belief that AB was telling the truth and that Mr. Zayas Lopez was therefore guilty. So we'd ask this court to reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
I just need a seventh grader to help me with this clock.
I don't need that much time.
I have absolutely no idea what in the heck just happened. Why don't you start, and I'll just fake it as if I actually know how much time you have.
I'll just go with the 82 minutes there.
I have no idea what's happening. Just go ahead and start, and we'll all let out a cheer if I ever...
I'm hoping I don't need to take the full 10 minutes.
Let's do it this way. Yeah, we're going to do it this way. Hey... Hey, I don't need a seventh grader. I just need a lot of time. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ian Eath, representing the state of Washington, the respondent in this matter. I will focus my attention on the issue that the appellant has discussed here this morning, which is the mistrial motion. We're asking this court to affirm the conviction in this case because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in declining to declare a mistrial because the nurse's statements to the girl were not direct opinions about the credibility of the witness or the ultimate issue in this case. That's what really matters in this case. Before you advance to the analysis of whether or not the irregularity was so serious that the only remedy was to grant a new trial, you have to start with the presumption that there was actually an irregularity in this case. And in this case, the facts and the record of this case show that there was no error and that the trial court certainly did not abuse its discretion in determining that the comment of the nurse practitioner in discussing her method of interviewing an 11-year-old girl rose to the level of a direct comment on the veracity of the witness or the guilt. Again, I would remind the court that the standard review here is abuse of discretion, which comes down to whether or not any rational judge would decline to grant a mistrial. And in this case, there's no way you could possibly say that no rational judge would decline to declare a mistrial based on what this alleged irregularity was. Notably,
Do you concede there is irregularity?
Absolutely,
or there
not. I'm sorry, I'm not making myself clear. I absolutely do not concede there is an error.
So what about the argument related to the impropriety of the comment that was made? That I believe your testimony.
I believe you. That was not the comment that was made. If you look at the transcript, she didn't say, I believe you. And in cases where...
What did she say?
The quote was, and I'm sorry, I actually didn't write down the quote from the... But the trial court found was that there was no indication from the witness that she was making any evaluation about whether this child was credible or not. It's just something you say so that a child will talk, not that she was vouching. So the
court interpreted the comments as being reassuring.
Right. She interpreted the comments as simply her explaining how she puts an 11-year-old child at ease in the course of conducting an interview. The case law on...
Did she testify to that effect?
That's correct. She was explaining... Well, what happened in this case was that the nurse practitioner didn't remember anything.
So then she
was
reading
from her report.
Her report.
And so she was essentially saying, I said this, the girl responded this way.
So then we have the statement. So it's not an explanation.
But I would encourage you to go back and look at the statement, and I'm trying to find the statement now. The statement was, I told her and talked to her a little bit about how I see kids every day and that this has happened to other kids and that it was very brave that she told about it. And she told me about how he not told her to keep it a secret, but now her and her mom have talked about how they cannot keep secrets and cannot keep any sexual secrets. Nowhere in the statement does it say, I told her I believed her.
Well,
nowhere in the exchange.
It implies it when the statement says, this has happened to other kids, and then she goes on to say...
Well, I think that perhaps if you are willing to infer that there's an implication, that still does not rise to the level of reversible error in our jurisprudence as it comes to direct comments on an opinion of veracity or guilt. The case law that the appellant even cites for this proposition is very clear that where you rise to the level of a reversible error on an opinion of guilt is where the expert or the witness is directly asked for an opinion. In, for example, in the case that two cases that the appellant cites, one is Carson, the witness said, I trusted that the child had been sexually abused. And that was found to rise to a direct testimony on, what did you think? What was your opinion on her truth? In the other case that the appellant cites is Alexander, the expert directly testified that he personally believed that the child was not lying. He was directly asked, what was your opinion on whether or not this child was lying? So when you come to an abuse of discretion standard, the trial court was absolutely within its discretion in interpreting the comment of the nurse practitioner as simply something that was stated to put the child at ease. The nurse was...
Well, if we didn't agree with that, if we interpreted those statements as being an implied statement related to this, confirming that this happened, what's your response to
Well,
that?
Let's then move on and just, for the sake of argument, assume that this was somehow an irregularity. So then you move on to the rest of the analysis, which is, would any rational judge come to the conclusion that this irregularity was so serious in the context of everything else that was being presented in this trial that no remedy was sufficient to assure this man a fair trial than to grant a mistrial and start all over again? And certainly you cannot say that no rational judge would come to the conclusion that this judge did in this case. You had a remark that the nurse practitioner read from a report about giving the putting the child at ease. It's notable.
Well, it's not putting the child at ease. That is not what that comment says.
Okay. So I respectfully disagree with that, but let's assume...
Well, we have the words that she read.
Okay.
The words that she read don't say, I'm trying to put you at ease.
All right.
This has happened to other children. I'm glad you come forward to tell the truth.
Well, she never actually says that, so I'll disagree with you on that. But it's also telling, and this court can infer from the fact that the defense counsel himself needed the Memorial Day weekend to decide that this was such a violation of a fair trial right that he needed to come back 4 days later after the remark was made and object to it and ask for a mistrial on the basis that it was an unfair opinion on the veracity or guilt of the witness. It wasn't even apparent to the defense counsel immediately upon the testimony being read into the record that this was a glaring opinion on the veracity or the guilt of the veracity of the witness or the guilt of the defendant. And this court can certainly look at that in determining whether the trial court abused its discretion. It's also not true from the record here that this is simply a case of he said, she said, as appellant continues to try to convince this court. She keeps, the appellant tries to portray this as a case where the victim made vague allegations that were not supported by any corroboration whatsoever, but that's not true from the record. There may not have been DNA evidence, for example. There may not have been forensic evidence because this abuse had gone on for months and months to the point where it was considered commonplace by the victim. But the corroboration came in the form of consistent accounts given to the other caregivers, in this case not just the nurse practitioner. It came in corroboration from her little sister, who witnessed particular parts of these episodes that she was able to recount to the jury. It came in the form of testimony from the little girl's mother that corroborated some of these accounts. It came in corroboration from the house guest who confirmed that an episode happened where the defendant kept the little girl home from school under false pretenses so he could abuse her. And it came from the forensic evidence of the defendant's own phone, where he was conducting internet searches for having to find pornography about, quote, having sex with his stepsister in the bath or stepdaughter in the bathroom, which is exactly what happened. So when you're looking at the totality of the evidence here and trying to decide whether this small irregularity, if you want to call it that, was so glaring that nothing short of a mistrial was...
With regard to this witness,
yes,
what did she testify to as being her ultimate conclusion?
She didn't, as I recall,
was that she couldn't conclude, right?
That she could have been.
No, that's not what, well, if you're telling me that's what it says, I guess I'll look at the record.
Well, my recollection of the record
is that she conducted her interview, she conducted her examination, and she said it was inconclusive, that she had no conclusion.
I'll trust you on that.
You don't have to trust me.
No, I can't find it, and it's escaped my mind at the moment. My focus is on whether or not she was ever...
If she testified, if her ultimate testimony was that she couldn't reach a conclusion, and if there was no objection lodged to the testimony until 4 days later, is there reason to believe that the jury was left with the impression that she couldn't reach a conclusion or that she was vouching for the witness's testimony? That was the purpose of my question.
Well, I guess I would agree with you there.
Well, I'll anticipate that at this point. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few points in rebuttal, Your Honors. Regarding defense counsel making the motion for mistrial 4 days later, If Your Honors look at the transcript, it was actually 60 pages later. So as far as the trial was concerned, it was fairly contemporaneous.
Wasn't fairly contemporaneous. It was after the witness had completed her testimony and left the courtroom, days later.
Well, in the transcript, it was 60 pages later.
I don't care what the transcript says. On God's earth, it was days later, days after she had left the courtroom. So she wasn't available for any questioning that would have been possible if there had been a contemporaneous objection.
It was still possible for the court to issue a curative instruction, Your Honor, but it turns out the court did not see that this was improper vouching and did not give one. And so we would argue...
But by delaying an objection, if one should have been sustained, you deprive the opposing party of the opportunity to ask a different question in a different way and elicit testimony. So you want us to say it's fine, lay back, don't do everything for several days, make sure that witness is well away from the courtroom, then lodge your objection, and then if we can't have an effective curative instruction, it's a mistrial.
That's the rule
you're looking for, right?
I have three responses to Your Honor. First is there was a contemporaneous objection. It was that this
totally
was not...
a totally different basis.
That's true, Your Honor. That's true. It was on a different basis, and the court actually agreed with defense counsel initially on that basis, that it wasn't pertinent to medical diagnosis. In fact, the statement wasn't even attributable to AB. It was the advanced nurse practitioner's testimony.
So how did the objection on an entirely different basis help you with regard to this argument?
Well, Your Honor, there's case law in the context of prosecutorial misconduct in closing where if defense counsel moves for a mistrial based on that, it's considered preserved for appeal. And I guess that's the Lindsay case, which I can cite in supplemental authority. I understand, Your Honor, in talking about real life, this is 4 days later, but there was still an opportunity for the court to do something about it, to mitigate the prejudice. And the problem is
the court didn't have the array of opportunities that the court was entitled to have. The court's entitled to have a contemporaneous objection on the proper basis in order to have an array of possibilities for a remedy, and then exercise its discretion as to which one is possible. Here, the defense attorney unilaterally took away the primary remedy that the court would have imposed if it thought it was wrongdoing, and that is to sustain an objection, strike the testimony, and ask for a different question to be asked. You unilaterally took that away.
Your Honor, I understand Your Honor's point. I would just say that the court still could have issued, if it had recognized the improperness of Ms. Mettler's testimony, it at least could have provided the remedy of a curative instruction at the time defense counsel made the motion for mistrial. It could have said, please disregard her testimony. It was not admissible. And we would be in a better position than we are on appeal. So, Your Honor,
did you request a curative instruction?
Well, Your Honor, the defense counsel moved for a mistrial. There's no point in requesting a curative instruction if the court doesn't even see that the testimony was improper. Here, the court said, I find that this is just something that interview specialists say. So the court didn't even recognize it was improper. So it would have been useless for defense counsel to ask for a curative instruction at that point. One final thing. The state points out the cases of Carson and Alexander, and sure, the statements in those cases were perhaps more blatant than in this case, but the statements here still cross the wrong side of the line, and it's our position that this is preserved for appeal because defense counsel objected not once but twice. Thank you, Your Honors.
Next up, the state versus Garcia.